This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in March.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Robin Patton about her new book, The Mountain: Journeys in High Places. Since antiquity, mountains have captured the human imagination. The Mountain takes readers into higher realms, exploring the complex kinship between mountains and human thought, traditions, and ways of being. Told through the author's own journeys, the narrative ranges across cultures and iconic naturalists to consider how varied ideas and experiences related to mountains, from sacred to scientific, romantic to retreat to simply home, are all facets of the same intricate topography. A freelance writer, naturalist, and teacher, Robin Patton has spent years exploring and writing about some of the world's great mountains. She received the John Burroughs Nature Essay Award for The Carcass Chronicle. Her writing has appeared in The Guardian and the Georgia Review, among others. Robin Patton, thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Beautiful book. Let's just start out having you read a passage from the book. Give people a taste of this. I'll have you read the first two or three paragraphs from the book.
All right. Yeah, this is the first section, very beginning of the book. The Fellfield Ridge leading to Monument Mountain's crest is rocky and near barren, yet still holds life. Scattered cushions of moss campion and alpine forget-me-nots, mats of creamy-petaled mountain avens, the occasional pika bleeding to remind any passerby of the local residents. That day, the alpine flowers were in full bloom, bursting with color and scent to attract their pollinators during the brief growing season. I walked upward along the ridge, pausing to kneel beside the flowers, bending down as if in prayer to inhale their fragrance, then rising to look up into an endless sky that stretched beyond the horizon, outward and upward to realms only imagination could follow. The ridge took me to the summit, thousands of feet higher than the sea, a rounded top that unfolds from the rocky fell field into an expansive alpine meadow swathed in green and a wildflower brilliance of golden cinquefoil, maroon shooting stars, white bistort, magenta lousewort, azure bluebells, dark blue lupin. All the blooms were of short stature, but with the flowers the size of their low elevation cousins, a bounteous garden of color clinging to the ground, yet seeming to weave into the clear sky so close overhead. I lay in the meadow with eyes closed, drowning in abundance, drenched with sunlight and infused with scent. I sat up to watch how the slight breeze brushed the grass and swayed the garden. I stood and walked over to a lichen-splashed boulder and perched on it, arms raised with the utter joy of being. A peregrine falcon flew over, circling, gliding slowly over toward my perch. I imprinted the markings into memory, dark head, barred chest, checkered underwings, wanting to positively identify the bird later. As the raptor spiraled above, sweeping by again, my thoughts abandoned rational analysis, my mind floating with the bird till the falcon descended, stretching out talons to alight on a neighboring rock, eyeing me. Looking down to steady my feet, seeking stillness to hold that moment, I noted tiny bones, blood stains, creamy streaks of excrement on the very rock where I stood. It seems my perch was the peregrine's dining table. The falcon tilted her head, fixing her eyes on mine in an unblinking stare. Human and peregrine perched side by side under that sky, within that meadow, those eyes looking into me with the stare of a creature holding wild in its veins and the heavens in its grasp. My existence shrank, myself reduced to something less than those minuscule bones at my feet. Yet I was there, part of the flow of that event, of that narrative that has no beginning and will not end. I stepped down from the falcon's rock, moving off slowly. The falcon's wings spread, the bird lifting into the sky to disappear into the airy distance, leaving that moment behind, something I have never done, being the human who I am.
Beautiful. That's the first section from the book, The Mountain. The author, Robin Patton, is with us. I like that at the very end. The falcon left the moment behind, something you've never done, being human.
Yeah, I think there are moments in all of our lives that give us a broader perspective. And I think that's part of this book, is how those are easy to find on mountains. And
yeah.
That was one of those moments. I still hold that.
Yeah, beautiful moment, powerful moment. So there are a lot of reasons why people go into the mountains, right? The people are attracted to the mountains. You know, you drive up there, hike, climb, take a pilgrimage, right? I guess photography, writing, just enjoying a lot of recreation as well. Why have you gone into the mountains?
I was born there. I think that the first chapter, as we've talked about, is my experience in Montana. And I feel, why did I go to the mountains? Well, I really just started my life in the mountains. And so they are part of who I am. And so I return to them. I always say, I hike to get out. I don't get out to hike. You know, it's, I just, part of me is in the mountains.
Yeah.
And always will be.
Hike to get out of what? Out of your ordinary life?
I hike to get out into the mountains. You know, people say, I'm going to the mountains to hike. And it's like, no, I'm hiking to go out into the mountains. And I just need to be out there. And so, yeah. And to get out, I guess that's a very good way to get out into a connection outside of our human bubble, as I think of it. You know, we live our lives, we're a human society, we're a human culture. And to get out, especially solo, is to get out of that human bubble for a while and remember our place in a larger community of life.
And you write that you can do some of that in the desert, right? Or in the ocean, or whatever it might be. But the mountain is special, especially to you, I guess, because, you know, you can start where you are and then you go up into the heavens, right? Also, mountains are quite singular often. You know, there's one peak that you might be interested in.
Yeah. I actually spent a lot of time thinking about that, because people do write about the desert, the ocean, the Arctic, these vast distances that I started calling them existential landscapes, because they draw you out of yourself with this vastness. But I think the mountain is special because it's almost a being. It has a foot, it has a head, and it's grounded in the earth and yet reaches up into the heavens. And I think that stretch where, for example, when I'm standing on a rock in the alpine meadow surrounded by these tiny alpine flowers, and yet I can look up into the heavens, I can look out down into the valleys below, and it stretches you, I call it the micro macro spatial temporal stretch. You're stretched in time and space in ways that I don't think you can find quite the same thing in the desert or the ocean, because there isn't that shape, that form, that groundedness in the earth and that touching of the sky above, the cosmos above.
I wonder if you could read the quotation you have at the beginning of the book. At the very beginning. You talk about the mountain, lowercase, is a little harder to do when we're talking about it. It's very apparent in the print, right? Lowercase m, the mountain, the actual physical mountain, right? And higher case mountain with the uppercase m, which is the idea.
Okay, yes, this is a little, this is in the front matter of the book. And what I wrote early on, I wrote this. Across the planet are mountains, physical places found on a map. There is also the mountain. The mountain is an idea, a thought, a memory of something from another time, a symbol, an icon. The mountain situates the human in the greater cosmos. The mountain is meaning. The mountain is what we seek but cannot know. It is what some hope to find in mountains.
Mm-hmm. And you certainly hope to find that, right, in mountains?
Yes.
Yes, yes. You're not just going out there to hike, right? Kind of with this idea, you talk about W.H. Murray from Scotland. Just in passing, you give this wonderful anecdote. I wonder if you'd talk about that. The first draft of his book was an unusual medium.
Yeah. Here, I just pulled up this passage. So Scotland's W.H. Murray described his high mountain experience in mountaineering in Scotland and undiscovered Scotland, the first draft of which was written on toilet paper while Murray was imprisoned in a World War II POW camp. Perhaps in such horrific conditions, Murray found soul sustenance in remembering such moments as this when he had just reached a summit at sunrise. You want me to read that passage?
Yeah, that'd be great, yeah.
So Murray wrote, "The mind fails one how miserably and painfully before great beauty. It cannot understand, yet it would contain more. Mercifully, it is by this very process of not understanding that one is allowed to understand much. For each one has within him the divine reason that sits at the helm of the soul, of which the head knows nothing. Find beauty, be still, and that faculty grows more surely than grain sown in season. However, I must be content to observe that here, for the first time, broke upon me the unmistakable intimation of a last reality underlying mountain beauty. And here, for the first time, it awakened within me a faculty of comprehension that had never before been exercised." And so basically, he had just reached the summit at sunrise, and he realized you really can't know these things, but you can intuit them, you can hold them within, and we all have that within us to find that beauty, be still, and then that faculty grows within you.
The mountain, you talk a little bit about this. Mountains produce awe, right? Also, there could be a sense of trepidation, right? There's a danger in some cases, right? I'm remembering that my mountains growing up, the eastern Uinta Mountains out in the Uinta Basin, right? Beautiful, beautiful mountains. That I'm remembering a couple of instances where I went up with my father, and he would go stand on the edge of the cliff, as I recall it, with his toes sticking out. He'd say, "Tommy, come on up." I'd say, "No, Dad, I'd prefer you to come back, because I'd still like to have a father." He was embracing it a little more, right? But there is a sense of awe, a sense of wonder, but also a sense of danger.
Yes, and there's a chapter in here that focuses on the Romantic mountain, because the Romantics had this philosophy of the sublime. And the sublime, we kind of watered that word down in this day and age and use it for everything from cookies to ice cream. But back in the philosophy of the Romantics, the sublime was things that had awe, that feeling of just incredible wonder and amazement, but they also had terror. And so the Romantics would go purposely to mountains because they could have the sublime experience. They were looking for these deep emotional experiences, those moments that you hold on to and never let go. And so the mountains held that because they hold both this incredible deep beauty and awe and wonder, but there's also that element of terror. And I think it's that element of terror that helps situate you in the cosmos, in a better, you know, that we are not the dominant creatures that we think we are. that there is this terror out there that's part of the mountains. And I think John Muir was sort of the character I followed in that romantic chapter. And he would definitely go out and do just wild and crazy things. And whether he was looking to embrace both the beauty and the terror at the same time, consciously or not, that's what he was doing. Going up into the tops of trees and thunderstorms and things like that.
Really? Yeah. What was he looking for, do you think, with that?
I think it was very much this sort of romantic idea. And like I said, I don't know if he was consciously seeking it, but it to embrace both that beauty and that wonder and that terror all at the same time just rips open your emotions and your feelings and opens you up. It starts to break down the boundaries between you and that world around you, I believe. And you're definitely sort of had gone through that boundary of the human bubble that I was talking about earlier. And I think that's what the romantics are looking for, is that sublime experience.
You write that the mountain can change a person, right? And in part because you encounter the mountain, what that brings, right? But you also bring what you are to the mountain. And there's something in that interchange.
Definitely. And it's a complex, I think I refer to it as a dialogue that we can have with a mountain, because we are all, I mean, I think of my upbringing, and I discuss that some in this book, where I had parents who, my father was a scientist, my mother was sort of an amateur naturalist, my grandmother was an artist, and my grandfather was an intellectual, but he was very much connected to the land. And their mentoring helped me see the landscape in ways that I might not have if I didn't have them. So we are, I think, we're influenced by our mentors, by our relatives, by those people around us. We're also very much influenced by our culture of how we perceive mountains. And different cultures have different ways of interacting with their mountains. And so if you're from a certain culture or you have a certain upbringing, that is what you bring to the mountain. But if you spend time anywhere, be it the mountains or elsewhere, I mean, that experience works on you too. And it's one of the things that I always feel about travel or spending time in mountains in other countries, is experience, seeing and living, you can learn a lot simply through experience. But we do, we all have a history, but we all carry with us certain ways of thinking and seeing. But hopefully people, you know, you can be open enough to change as you grow. And the mountains can definitely provide an experience like that.
Yeah, certainly. Well, let's take a brief break. We'll come back with more with Robin Patton. We're talking about her new book, The Mountain, Journeys in High Places. You can pre-order the book right now. We've got the link. We'll have that link on our website as well, as well as a link to Robin Patton's website, robinpatton.com. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in March.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer Robin Patton about her new book, The Mountain, Journeys in High Places. You can pre-order that right now. And that's from University of Utah Press. So, Robin Patton, tell me about, I guess, your original mountain. This is Montana. I know your experience that you read at the beginning of the book with Peregrine Falcon, that was Monument Mountain, I guess, in Montana?
Yeah, it's a mountain. It's part of a larger stretch of mountains in south central Montana. And our ranch was delightfully situated between Yellowstone Park and Wilderness Area. And I think being there, and I was given the freedom, as I say, we have our upbringings, I was given the freedom to as growing up, just explore these mountains. And I spent quite a bit of time there, both just me and my grandparents when I was very young, or with family in the summers. But I also, in later years, spent a lot of solo time there. And I think having that opportunity, which is very unique, to be able to walk out your door into wildlands and provides a different perspective. And I was thinking about this in terms of breaking through that human bubble. It provides a perspective where you're not a spectator anymore. It's not scenery, you're not watching wildlife. It's more becoming part of that community, that mountain community of non-humans. And by spending most of my life near or living on the ranch, I knew who lived where and when they would come and go. And I spent a lot of time in the high country and got to experience that movement from down low, where you've got the forests and the lower elevations, and the change that happens as you go up into that high alpine. So I think growing up with that ability to just wander in the mountains, I didn't have to travel. I didn't have to go anyplace. I could just walk out the door and go. And it was home in every sense of the word. And it's such a unique experience. And it did change my life. So, and I do thank my parents and grandparents for providing that doorway into being comfortable there and knowing more about it than you can, being taught, being shown, having my grandfather show me what grows where, when, and instilling that curiosity from the beginning of, how does this place work through the year, through the seasons, through space, through time? So I was lucky in that sense.
You talk about juxtaposition of the vista, you call it, right? You're up on top of a mountain, you can see forever, in quotes, right? At the same time, you're noticing the lichen on this rock, right? That was in the passage that you read at the beginning of the program. And that's kind of an interesting to have those two perspectives. At the same time, you're looking inward as well, right? Have all those perspectives at once.
I think that's the whole key to the mountain experience, to all of these different ways of seeing, is that you have these different perspectives of this micro, the lichens at your feet, the rock at your foot, the tiny little alpine flower that looks so fragile, yet it can exist in this alpine environment. And then you look out and up and beyond and realize, and then all of a sudden you're shrunk down to nothing. But as I said in that beginning paragraph or section, you're there. You are not nothing. You are part of that. And I love the last section is on Norway. It's with a philosopher, Arne Næss. And he said, we are not floating in the current of life and time. We are the current. We are part of it. And it's that stretch in both time and space that you can feel standing on a rock on a mountain that allows you to feel part of it. And so I think that's the amazing thing about the mountain experience is you are both completely humbled, and yet you are there at that point in time, at that point in space, with all of those perspectives, inward, outward, and in all directions. And so you can get to that feeling. I walk through in my chapters these different ways of thinking about mountains, be that sacred or romantic or scientific. They all can lead you to that expansive perspective.
I'm thinking about you said you grew up with a mountain, right? It was actually your home. I had the same experience, not that not that I had a ranch, right? And the mountain was part of the ranch, but And still today, I can, you know, I can drive 10 minutes and I'm up in the mountains, right? It's a wonderful thing. A lot of the people listening, probably the same thing. I was thinking of some brief periods where I've lived apart from mountains and just the disorientation that comes. I'm a mountain person. Yeah. And so it has been pretty cool to live in flat places where you can see the horizon. You think that I can see forever, but I'm disoriented. I don't like it. I like to be able to orient myself by where are the mountains. And I guess that's a kind of if you grow up with mountains, you have a different perspective. I don't know if that changes a person if they actually grew up with mountains.
I think it does. I think it does. And I'm thinking about what you're saying in terms of where we started on the difference between the ocean, the desert, the mountain. And the mountain, it has its intricacies, it has its folds, it has its altitudes, and it has its ridges and valleys, and it's very much a being, a landscape that you can embrace in different ways. You can be on top, you can be within it, and it orients you within in space that makes it something that I think we can. It folds us, it embraces us. And then as mountain people, we get out and go onto the plains or out to the ocean and go, whoa, wait a minute. There's not that topography to ground us. Mm-hmm. And I think that is that characteristic of mountains, to go back to the mountain will ground you. It will lift you up. But it will ground you as well.
Mm-hmm. That's probably what I feel when I'm on, you know, flat land, so there's no mountains around. I feel ungrounded, right? I feel disoriented, yeah. I wonder if you talk a bit about, chapter 2 is titled The Sacred Mountain. So you talk about how, you know, from time immemorial, people have seen mountains as sacred places. You go to the Old Testament, right? Moses was called, where was he called to meet God? It was the top of a mountain. So in this chapter, you talk about a mountain in New Zealand. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so Narahoi, it's a volcano in the Tongariro National Park, and it and the other volcanoes in that area are sacred to the Maori people. So in New Zealand, you can book these treks and go from one hut to the next. And I was over in New Zealand for a few months, and this was one of the treks I did, was around this volcano, Narahoi. And when I first booked this trek, I didn't realize it was sacred land, but I did my homework before I left and found out more about it and realized this whole area was sacred to the Maori. But they have a different perspective on the mountains than a lot of European cultures and other cultures as well. The mountains are actually their ancestors. There is a genie, you know, the Wakapapa, the creation sequence started with the mountains. And so they are seen as ancestors. And so to stand on the top of a mountain is to stand on the head of an ancestor, and it is tapu. It is forbidden. You know, it's not something you should do. It breaks the sacred, the sacredness of that mountain. And yet European cultures, climbing mountains has been part of the history of European cultures for a long time. And this particular volcano, Narahoi, happened to be Mount Doom in the Lord of the Rings movies. Mm. It is the volcano that was used. So a lot of people know it as Mount Doom, not as the sacred Maori mountain. And it has been climbed by many, many people who I suspect never knew that they were breaking the tapu of the Maori people. But to me, it set up a very interesting question of that interaction of cultures in a sacred land, of different perspectives on what is sacred. And sacred mountains are seen in different ways, and some of the sacred mountains are, you know, people go to the tops of them. I mean, you just mentioned Moses going to the top of a mountain. So there's these cultural differences, and it goes back to what do you bring to the mountain? And so that chapter looks at that. But it also muses on why do so many cultures have sacred mountains? Why do essentially all cultures have sacred mountains? And that goes back to the things we were talking about earlier, about the mountain puts you closer to the heavens. And yet it's here, grounded, where we humans are living. And so cultures across the planet have their sacred mountains. Mm. So I have found it as an individual, but so have many other individuals, to the point where cultures create these sacred mountains. Mm. And they do it in different ways, so there's conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. That's did you resolve it or do you remain in conflict? Yeah, interesting topic. I want to move to chapter 3, which you call the Scientific Mountain, and you talk about the Tetons. Many of our listeners will be very familiar with the Tetons. In this chapter, you talk about how the two ideas can coexist, right? Mystical and scientific. Tell me about that.
There is no conflict. They're different ways of knowing, I guess you would say, which can exist within one person. I would speak from experience. mystical, I think of it. How do I say this? Sort of emotional, subjective, mystical. I referenced Alexander von Humboldt in that chapter, The Scientific Mountain. And he was the one who brought to the scientific world that all is connected, all is one, which is something he found or realize scientifically while on a mountain in South America, Chimborazo. But he spoke about that there's order in the world, and that's sort of this material order, the things that science records and the data that shows the orders that happen. But there's adornment, and adornment to him is that the sense of beauty, the sense of aesthetics, the sense of the spiritual, the mystical, all of that. And that's woven into the order of the universe. And there's no conflict there. They both exist. And it's why I couldn't become a scientist, because I love the science. I love the order. And I write about this question that was thrown out to me in my master's thesis, is there order in nature? And I said, not as much as we'd like to think, but there is order in nature. But I had grown up, as I say, wandering around in these mountains of Montana, and there's so many things that you see and feel and witness that go beyond just the science of the world. You know, the world is not purely rational. And I can read this paragraph. May I read this paragraph?
You bet. That'd be great.
I should have answered that defense question differently. For as Olaus Murray, who I write about in there, and Humboldt before him knew, yes, there is order in nature, a beautiful order of celestial orbits and migratory movements and seasonal change, of birth and death and nutrients that move in an orderly fashion through an ecosystem. Of vegetation zones that shift in a predictable manner as one moves up the mountain slope. The order is exquisite. I find nothing wrong with quantifying and modeling, finding order, learning more, and so having a better understanding. But call it adornment, call it what you will, there is simply more. I can't stop at the border of the box. The wide eyes of the dead calf, the contentedly grazing grizzly bear, the piercing stare of the peregrine, the light in the wolf's eyes guarding its young, The scream of the first hawk of spring, the coil of a crinoid entombed on a ridgetop seabed, the solitary raven so black he is silver, flying overhead on a bright summer day when I stand in a field of alpine flowers and the blood runs sweet through my veins. The visceral existence of those moments drove my answer that day of my defense. I can't put those moments, those beings, those places, that life in a box.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. People will want to know, did you get your master's? Was it a successful defense, even though you were saying things maybe the committee didn't want to hear? Yeah.
Well, the next paragraph says, I passed my master's degree defense, went on for a PhD, then a research position, but I didn't have the disposition of an academic scientist, mm-hmm. and it didn't last.
Yeah.
Yet I will always be an ecologist. It is a discipline that can fertilize wonder and nurture joy in the natural world, a foundation for that leap beyond the box. That's what the mountain, capital M, taught me.
Yeah, that capital M mountain. Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, let's take another break. We're talking with Robin Patton about her book, The Mountain, Journeys in High Places. That's available for pre-order right now. We're talking about it on the program today, and we'll talk more about it following this brief break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in March.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Robin Patton about her book, The Mountain, Journeys in High Places. That's available for pre-order right now. The Mountain, Journeys in High Places. By the way, Robin Patton's website is robinpatton.com. So, Robin Patton, I want to have you talk a little bit about, it's Chapter 5, The Solo Mountain. You focus on Nan Shepherd, who wrote extensively about the mountains of her homeland. I think that's Scotland, right?
Is it? Right.
So what draws you to the writings of Nan Shepherd?
Nan Shepherd wrote a little book, The Living Mountain. She actually wrote it in the 30s, and it didn't get published until the 70s. And it focuses on the Cairngorm Mountains of Scotland, extensive mountain range, and her writing is very in-depth, musing, informed, and it's just a beautiful nature book. And she liked to go to the Cairngorm solo, and I set off one summer to follow Nan Shepherd, to take her book, The Living Mountain, and go solo into the Cairngorm Mountains and follow her footsteps and take her words with me. And to do that really opens up a place. I have found if you have somebody's writings who knows a place intimately, that they can help you see it in different ways. So you bring both your own history and then another person's way of seeing. And her way of seeing the Cairngorms was beautiful. And it was quite the experience to be in there for 11 days, 10 nights, 11 days solo with Nan Shepherd as my guide.
Now, when you say Scottish Highlands, it kind of evokes a romantic image, even if that image isn't very clear, right? Movies, literature, you know, it's, tell me about the actual Cairngorms.
You know, the Highlands are, it's that romantic view. Yes, the Highlands landscape definitely fulfills, you get out there and there's the mountains, they're not high. The highest mountain in the UK is Ben Nevis, and I think that's 4,000 feet high. So they're not tall mountains, but I always say they're not big, but they're mighty. And the Cairngorms themselves are a very interesting mountain range. They're quite different from other places because it's a mountain range that was formed from erosion. It's like this high plateau that was eroded down. And so it has very rounded tops, but it has, I think the next three highest mountains of the UK are in the Cairngorms. The weather there is very changeable and can be quite intense. And it's just a very wild feeling place. So, but it is different from much of the Highlands, but the Highlands are stunning mountains.
So you go from that solo experience there to a chapter called the Peopled Mountain. So communal relationship, right? And there are many communities who live in mountains, and you wanted to experience this, right? This was in Scotland, but you ended up in the high desert of southeastern Utah. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I have been going over to Scotland for decades, and I wanted to live there. I wanted to live in this. There was this very small community in the Highlands of Scotland, and it is a second home. It still remains a second home, but I wanted to make it permanent home, but I couldn't ever get the work visa to make it a permanent home. But I was still trying, and I just connected with that place because of the human community there. And I to be in a small community within the mountains, it was sort of my dream situation, and I never could make it work. What was interesting, so I was there in Scotland when the pandemic hit. I was there in Scotland when the first lockdown came. And I was staying at a friend's place, and she said, "Just stay, just stay here for a couple months and let the whole thing go away." And I said, "Yeah." My parents were in Montana, and it's like, no, I need to be home in case something happens to my parents. And so it took weeks to get actually home, but I couldn't get to Scotland for a couple of years after that, during the pandemic. And a friend who I'd worked with in Scotland for a tour group, they had a house for rent in Little Bluff, Utah. And they said, "Well, you can't go to Scotland. Do you want to go to Bluff and you can rent the house?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll rent it for 3 months." And I fell in love with the community, and it happens to be in a desert, but and we agreed, Bluff is a little bit like a rural Scottish Highland community. It's small and full of eclectic people, and we sort of support each other. And so I ended up in the desert. I'm a mountain person living in the desert, and go figure, life takes us in strange
Yeah.
directions.
So I would have thought these two landscapes experiences would be completely different. You're saying there is some similarity between the Scottish Highlands and that, that high desert.
Yeah, and the other interesting thing, and I've had this conversation with other people, is there are similarities between the sort of this canyonland high desert and the mountains, because there is this feeling of space, but because it's canyonlands desert, it's not, you can get into the canyon. So no, there's that grounding that we were talking about before. It's not just flat land. There's also sort of that similar feel of being able to reach out in different perspectives, to get out of that human bubble and out into a place where there's time and space change. So the desert is not so much different from the mountain as we might think, and the communities are similar. So I'm making a home here in the desert, and it's working.
Yeah. I'm intrigued by Bluff that people I talk to who live in Bluff, and it's more than you might think that I've talked to who live in Bluff. Right? I've talked to a certain percentage of the people that live in, the 200 people live in Bluff. They
Yeah.
all they tend to love it. And by the way, you got some spectacular mountains. You can drive briefly and get to the
Oh yeah.
Abajos, right? So it's beautiful
Yeah.
mountains there. Just a couple
And you can
minutes.
see them. You can see
You can
them.
see them, yeah, kind of that grounding. So just a couple of minutes left. What's the top takeaway that you hope people take from this discussion, from the book? What's the top thing, do you think?
I would say, I guess if there was something that I would have people take away from this book is to be open and aware and thoughtful when you move through the mountains, to let yourself have those boundaries break down, be it in the mountains or anywhere. I write about a little bit about this in the Scientific Mountain, having watched people run by me and not even notice that I was sitting there, and they're running through the Tetons and not seeing it. And I think that's my top takeaway, is to think about places in different perspectives and to think about things. I think if you feel that simultaneous humbleness and that simultaneous sense of belonging, that you want to take care of the place you're in. If you feel that sense of belonging to the greater community, to your human community and the greater community, you're going to want to take care of it. And in that last chapter, I talk about Arne Naess and his whole, he started the deep ecology movement. And that was his message, is you shift from doing things out of moral obligation, ethical duty, to acting beautifully, he called it, taking it from the philosopher Kant. You just want to take care of this planet and all of the communities, human and non-human.
Well, we've been talking with Robin Patton about her new book, The Mountain, Journeys in High Places, and that's available for pre-order right now. Robin Patton, thanks so much. Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. here. We're talking with Rich Herman, who, amongst other facets of his life, is an amazing nature photographer. He takes amazing photos of mountains, lakes, ethereal aspects of life that he takes the time to enjoy and share, like ponds in Iowa with fog on them. And this week, a possibility of northern lights shining in the northern states and Canada, including Iowa and Wyoming. And thanks to Noah for the forecast, by the way, on that. And with this in mind, how you doing, Rich?
Hey, I'm doing really well, Leo. Thank you so much for letting me have be on your show. I love listening to all the things that you give us information on the Earth and space and all the things that are going on in a very short, concise program, which I really appreciate. So thank you, sir. So currently I'm in Iowa, and that's where we have a home in Iowa. And also we spend a lot of time in Colorado. I have a son that lives in Colorado. My wife and I go out there quite often. And luckily, last year there were two events that happened in Iowa that had to do with northern lights. And so one of your latest episodes was talking about this, you know, just the beauty of space and all the different stars. And I just kept thinking that, you know, we need to keep looking up, right? And just
yeah.
being aware of the universe, because it's so beautiful sometimes. It's amazing.
It truly is. So with that in mind, you've been taking incredibly, I agree completely, that's just to look up and look at what's all around us in the photos. People can see that on your website.
Richherman.com.
These amazing photos you've taken, and all of them, when people look at your website.
The very first time I saw the Northern Lights was we had a trip to Norway for a week. And I was lucky enough to be up in near the Lofoten Islands of Norway, and I'd never seen Northern Lights my entire life. And so when they appeared, you could see them with your naked eye, very intense, beautiful green colors and patterns. And so luckily, you know, I had my camera with me, and I tried to capture that beauty. And I was really struck by how difficult it is to really capture some of the way it moves so quickly. And people say that northern lights dance, and they really do. I mean, once they're there, you think they're going to be there for, you know, quite a long time, but they're not, like literally minutes. They move and morph and change, and then they're in a different part of the sky. And it takes some time just to understand like how beautiful things are before you can even concentrate on taking a photo. It's crazy. You know? And yeah, so I love the atmospheric conditions of Earth, and to be able to capture the fog, snow, rain, clouds, you know, whatever is happening. That's not just a regular, normal, you know, sunny day. Anything that's different, it just seems like it sheds a different light, not only in the sky, but everything that you see. And that's what I just love about photography.
Makes you feel good.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you've seen the northern lights in Norway, and where else have you taken some photos?
And just last year, it was in Iowa. There was two events, one in May and one in October of last year. And it was just phenomenal. I mean, it was really hard to see with the naked eye. You could see little pieces of green, the greenish kind of glow off in the distance if you look to the northern sky. But when I set up my camera with the tripod at about a 5 to 8 second exposure, and that's when the magic, you could just see the colors on the sensor. I mean, it just took that much longer for the light, you know, for that light to hit the sensor and to saturate it. Whereas if you would have probably been up in Canada, it might have been, you know, like you probably would have seen the actual blues and the purples and the different hues with your naked eye. But down here in the United States, it was a little bit different. But I was so happy to see color. I mean, I just didn't even know that kind of stuff existed. But it was so faint with the naked eye. So I was really thankful that my camera was able to have a long exposure. And yet I had all the equipment set up for, you know, to try and capture that.
Amazing. That's so great. And I was able to see some of those photos, and they were incredible. And, you know, the amazing thing is all the facets you're talking about, to see different things of nature during the day and in the afternoon, and the lighting in the dusk, and then to see the northern lights and the stars at night. It seems like you had a picture of the northern lights with the planet in it one time.
Oh yeah, it was the actual moon.
The moon.
It was our, yeah, and the moon was really close to the horizon, but it was far enough up, and I was in a place that was kind of wide open in Iowa, and so we had the northern lights, the moon going on, and it was just one of those moments where you look back and think, wow, you know, is that ever going to happen again in my lifetime? Will I ever be able to see anything like that? And hopefully it was recorded in a way that, you know, it brings back good memories for anybody that's ever seen anything like that. The only thing I wanted to say about the northern lights and is that the part that really makes it, I think, special for a lot of people is that the fact that they're never the same. And no matter, you know, how many times you've probably seen northern lights, they're probably never, ever the same. They're just so magically different and beautiful. And that's one of the things that the things in nature in general, you know, you can walk by a tree four times a day, but if the light is different, it's going to become something more special to you, right? And you're going to see things that you never saw before, but it's still there. It's just one of those weird things about light and magnetism and the earth, everything coming together, just like all the things you talk about in your program, the magic of space and universe and how it interacts with us and our bodies. And yeah, it's just an amazing area to explore, and the things we forget about sometimes during our normal lives. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Rich. Check out Rich's photos of the aurora on the Skywatcher Facebook page, and keep looking up. Look around and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.